Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner. We're about to start a conversation with Farhad Shadaya, author and award-winning journalist, distinguished writer in residence at the Arthur L. Carter Journalism Institute at New York University. Her latest piece that we discovered in The Nation magazine, How to Fix Journalism's Class and Color Crisis. And Farhad, welcome. Good to have you back with us.
Hey, Mark. How are you?
I'm well. How are you?
Fantastic, except for the state of journalism.
It is bad.
It's not just bad. It's bad because people have stopped being shocked at how bad it is. You know, it just keeps getting worse in terms of it becoming more of an elite profession with fewer roads in for people from different classes and different backgrounds. And we've seen this happening for literally a decade. And, you know, a friend of mine put it this way, like, when you hear a siren go off, you look around. But if the siren is going off for like 10 years, you know, as it has been with urban crises, you know, whether it's crime or whether it's, you know, family issues, if the siren is going off all the time, you stop listening.
So let's talk about the sirens, though. I mean, one of the things we talk about, and is that the numbers of African American journalists, let's just start there, that have lost their jobs on places like MSNBC and places like CNN, that were figures, and they're gone. I mean,
yeah.
What conversations are people having at the very top about this? Are they having conversations at all? Is there anything being said by folks who run these networks about why there's such a lack of African-American journalists and others on the air and what they've done to the ones who were there?
Well, you know, I mean, I point out near the top of the piece this rebranding effort by CNN, which,
right.
You know, which was very much paler than CNN actually is, which also kind of shocked me. I thought, well, if you're going to brand yourself, aren't you going to make yourself look better? But they just, I don't think they cared. You know, that was the point I was trying to make. But the overall numbers show, for example, that, you know, the loss in minority newsrooms, of minority hires in newsrooms on the print side has been double the rate of white employees. So basically, it's often a last hired, first fired. The company started getting more diverse, and then at a certain point, as newsroom cutbacks happened, they fired the newcomers, and that included a lot of diverse people. On the other end, though, there's like the people who are the longtime, you know, whether it's anchors on TV or longtime editors who often become the more expensive players in the newsroom, and they're also offered buyouts. So the few, you know, people of color in senior management and also people from working class backgrounds in senior management have also been decimated. So it's coming from both ends. And, you know, radio has got the worst diversity statistics of any part of our industry. 7.1% of radio employees are people of color, and it was 10% in 1990. You know, so that's pretty bad.
Well, I'm curious what you think. I know part of it may be the whole issue of systemic racism, which I want to touch on with you. But as I read that stat in your article, I thought about the medium that I work in, that you have worked in for years, and many people have worked in our world, in public media.
Mm-hmm.
And I really find that in some ways, I mean, public media, National Public Radio and others, are just as bad, if not worse at some levels, than some of the commercial media. In terms of the employment of people of color, especially black journalists, especially black men journalists.
I would agree with you there. I mean, with a caveat, which is that I've never worked in commercial radio, but certainly working in public radio, you know, it took NPR, for example, a long time to really have a good base of, you know, black men in the office. And, you know, it's certainly not where it needs to be, but part of it was that they started this new race reporting effort, which I actually think is doing quite well, but it's always a double-edged sword when you have, like, a specialized beat. You know, you want to see people, you want to see black White House correspondents, you want to see black national security correspondents. You know, you don't want just black people or brown people or anybody in any one role. And there, I think we still have a long way to go in public radio, because you see a lot of people of color doing, you know, urban affairs beats and
right.
race beats, and not as much integrated into the entire power structure.
One of the things you do talk about in this piece you wrote, and folks, lines are open to 410-319-8888. Farhad Shadaya is with us. Of course, grew up here in Baltimore and has gone on to do great things in public radio and public media and media in general. is that you talk about possible solutions.
Right.
Let's go through some of those. I'm curious how you think they would work. You talk mm-hmm. about diversifying media ownership and using less expensive technologies to launch strong media brands. Now, what do those two things mean?
Well, what you're seeing is that there's a lower point of entry into media, like literally anybody who can start a little blog or a Tumblr, you know, technically they are a media producer. It doesn't mean they get paid and it doesn't mean they have an audience. But what is happening is that with, streaming video, et cetera, you can start a media brand which then goes mainstream. It's a long shot, but I think that what's going to happen is there are going to be more intermediaries and more media incubators that help launch small companies. And I think of people like LaToya Peterson, who was named to Forbes 30 Under 30 journalist list, and she's an African-American blogger and business person who runs Racialicious.
Amazing young woman, yes.
Yeah. Yeah, it's hard to pronounce. Racealicious.
Racealicious, right.
.com. And so basically, you know, someone like her, she's an entrepreneur. She's just like, I don't see what I need out there. I'm going to start it myself. And digital technology does allow that. But what it doesn't do is break through some of the distribution pipelines. You know, you see the consolidation in the cable industry, for example. So it's easy to start like a blog or a webcast. It's harder to get TV distribution. But I think that what's going to happen is eventually people will start using, and it's already happening more on the entertainment side than the news side, but these entrepreneurial efforts, people will realize, oh, there's a reason they have an audience. We're not serving this audience. And they're going to start hiring or partnering with some of the innovators. So I see that as a good sign, but it's by no means it's not enough to say, oh, every black or brown person or every working class person who wants to go into journalism has to start their own thing, because that's not going to work. It's just, you know, it's still a real long shot. But I think that there needs to be an intermediary pipeline providing some funds to people who are innovating.
You spend a considerable time in your article talking about internships.
Yeah.
And the power of internships, especially the notion of paid internships, which don't happen anymore, how that affects communities of color and working communities.
Yeah, I mean, you know, what's interesting is that ProPublica just launched an intern investigation. They literally, I got this in my email the other day, and I'm really fascinated to see what they find. But because there's been such a rampant abuse of internships, unpaid internships, they've actually launched an investigation into it the same way they launched an investigation into drone strikes. And I do think that, like, unpaid internships are, you know, this kind of warfare against, the meritocracy, because I tell a story in the Nation piece of when I was in my mid-20s, I took in a young college graduate for 6 months because she wanted to do an unpaid internship in network news. And she ended up, you know, getting a job there, eventually winning an Emmy, you know, I mean, a great career, which is ongoing. But it would not have happened if she hadn't found someone willing to put her up in New York. And the most, complex part of the story is that she'd grown up partially in the foster care system. She had no parents, no legal guardians who could provide any funds for her. And so if someone who comes from a background that's not privileged has talent, it's increasingly difficult for that person to find a way in, whether you're black, brown, white, whatever. You know, it doesn't matter what color you are if you don't have the money. It's almost like there's a little toll booth when you're entering journalism, and it's called the endless unpaid internship, and you're expected, you're basically expected to subsidize your own career, and not everyone can do that.
And I think that one of the things this points out, and your article points out, and I think that people also don't realize, maybe, I think people in communities of color realize it more, but others do not realize often in the establishment of media, is what that diversity means. What the lack of heterogeneity in media, how it negatively affects how we look at the news, how we perceive life, and how we approach our stories.
Absolutely. I mean, if you look at some of, you know, even the coverage of the Boston Marathon bombing, you know, there's this random dark man who, you know, gets described. It's like, how many times have you heard, like, some random dark-skinned man? And, of course, the perpetrators were not dark-skinned at all. And there were even illustrations of the perpetrators that darkened their skin to make them look more menacing, presumably, which, you know, also happened with a Time magazine cover during the O.J. Simpson trial. So I think that, you know, when you have a newsroom like that, not a newsroom like that, but a newsroom where, you know, inevitably race comes up or class comes up, you need to have a diverse bench of people who can discuss the issue and point out different perspectives because, you know, none of this is God. We don't see everything. We all have a perspective. I believe that. Even though we're journalists, we certainly have perspectives. And so I found myself as a very young, you know, intern with a paid internship at Newsweek discussing the Central Park jogger trial, and I was pretty much the only person who said, look, our coverage is really, the tone of our coverage is out of control. And people just thought that meant I loved rapists, you know? And it's like, No, that's not the point. It's like the coverage is just not good. Lo and behold, we find out the men who were convicted were actually innocent. But even if they weren't innocent, I point out, it doesn't matter in terms of the news coverage. We should not be out to use racial stereotypes or use class stereotypes in our coverage, no matter what, whether, you know, it's, you know, someone's innocent or guilty or whether someone is, you know, lovable or hateable. Part of our job is to deal with our own issues and to present the fairest piece of journalism we can. And I argue that you can't have a newsroom that produces fair coverage of a diverse country unless you have a diverse staff. It's just not going to happen.
You know, one of the things I think about as I was reading your piece, and it was that how much this may also go to just what's happened to media. I mean, as you keep talking about it, it used to be a blue-collar medium. It used to be people mm-hmm. were like working-class reporters. Now it's kind of mostly white, wealthy journalists making lots of money at the top, and that in itself leaves out a lot of people who should be in the mix.
Yeah, it's you know, I think what's happening too is that you're having, like I said, you know, you have these amazing stories of someone who starts a little blog and then they get hired by the Washington Post or whatever. But those stories, people use those stories as a way of saying, well, isn't it easier to enter media? Can't you just start something? But that's, you know, even though I'm in favor of entrepreneurship and I'm actually, you know, working on some entrepreneurial media efforts myself that, you know, will take a while to bake. I don't believe entrepreneurship should be, you know, a reliable path for every single person. Not every single
right.
person, you know, has an entrepreneurial mindset. You know, I've spent years working for companies and only now have really begun to understand the media business, and not everyone's meant to be the business side. It's a huge burden. So, you know, that said, I think that the media business in general has been forced into a box by a kind of over-harvesting. It's kind of like overfishing or over-crabbing the bay, you know, where basically this profit was withdrawn from media companies by their larger, you know, corporate owners, whether it's a GE or a Disney or whatever. They basically said, well, you're not making as much money as entertainment divisions. Why aren't we getting better returns? And most journalism organizations, you know, that are of scale, you know, at least at some point were profitable, and many of them still are, but they're still seen as kind of losers, you know.
Right.
They're being measured by an entertainment scale. That's not the way we should measure news's value. It can make money. It's just not going to be the same returns as an entertainment property. So I think in general, there's a misguided managerial mindset about where the money is in media and how it should be, you know, extracted from media companies. And I think about, you know, this, I'll keep it brief, but as a little digression, I think about corporate structures. So, you know, an S-corp or a C-corp are really about maintaining shareholder value, whereas this the relatively newer B-corp has also a value metric.
Right.
So I think, like, what would Apple Computer be like if it was a B-corp? You know, would they act the same way in China? Would they have the same tax policies? And I think the same way about media. I wonder if, for example, there would eventually be a move to make more media companies be corporations. Because if we don't have a sense of social responsibility as well as profit-making, what industry should? I mean, we're supposed to be the watchdogs of the world, so we have to have a social interest. But on the larger financial level, we don't always see that playing out.
Farah Chidea, it's always a joy and a pleasure and learn so much when you're coming on our show. I appreciate you taking the time with the listeners today.
Well, I love it. It's so great to talk to you. And hey, we're...
And we'll talk very soon. And, folks, we're going to link to this article, How to Fix Journalism's Class and Color Crisis by Farah Chidea, now distinguished writer in residence at the Arthur L. Carter Journalism Institute at New York University, author and award-winning journalist. Farah, take care. We'll talk soon.
Thank you.
We're going to take a very brief break. And when we come back, we're going to jump into Ain't I Woman, Sojourner Truth. Hear the speech, talk about its relevance in the 21st century, where we've come since that moment in 1851.